You've just entered Untamed Dimension. Your navigator for this cosmic adventure is Space Ranger Adam O'Reilly, captain of the Starship Psychopath. Now, prepare yourself, Earthlings, for Untamed Dimension. Well, greetings, humans, and welcome to another edition of Untamed Dimensions, where once a week, or whenever it is I get around to doing another show, we talk to some of the most cutting-edge minds on the planet. And our guest today, Eric Stewart, certainly fits into that category. And we'll introduce him in a minute here after I do a little shameless self-promotion, which includes instructing you, my faithful listeners, to get out to the newsstands across this great land and pick up the latest edition of Paranoia, the Conspiracy Reader, which features as the cover story this month my article, Manson Family Secrets, Charlie, the Process, and RFK. And if you can't find it at your local newsstands, which wouldn't surprise me one little bit, then order it on the web at www.paranoiamagazine.com. Tell them Go Rightly sent you. I also want to plug a second web radio show I just started at Libertas Media called Radio Go-Go, which features a smorgasbord of conspiracies and high weirdness tossed into a surreal salad of audio oddities and mind-cracking interviews from such programs as Untamed Dimensions, Radio Mysterioso, From the Grassy Knoll with Visigoth, and Out There Radio. You can listen live on Tuesdays from 6 p.m. to midnight Pacific Standard Time at www.libertasmedia.org. That's www.libertasmedia.org. So check it out tonight, boys and girls. And remember, you can't go wrong if you go rightly. Okie dokie, enough of my nonsense, on with the show. Our guest today on Untamed Dimensions is Eric Stewart, who throughout the course of his 39 years on this planet has been an activist, a geek, a hippie, a bit of a punk, a nomad, a sailor, a pagan, a Buddhist, a Zoroastrian, an atheist, and a bunch of stuff in between. And he's going to talk to us today about the activism he became involved in during the late 1990s among other weighty topics. So let's welcome Eric Stewart right now. Eric, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear there. How you doing today, Eric?
Not bad. It really seemed as if a couple of things were going to conspire in the course of events to kill this in process, but I made it.
Okay.
I was breathing heavy when I gave you the call.
Well, thanks for being a trooper and making it aboard. Before we get into your activism today related to Echelon, could you talk about an incident that happened during a demonstration in Eugene, Oregon in 97 and how that set the stage for your later involvement in different types of activism?
Well, I think that the things that really drive us tend to be intense experiences. You know, they shape our opinions, they shape our attitudes, a lot of times unconsciously. June 1st, 1997 was a day that, as far as I knew when I awoke, was like any other day. I had been plugged into a variety of different kinds of environmental actions over the course of a few years. But as far as what was occurring here locally on that day, I had no idea to begin with. It was early in the morning. It was Eugene, Oregon, known as Tree City, USA. It is referred to often by locals as Black Sunday, a neat little label for it. Of course, that's been used repeatedly for a lot of different things. On June 1st, I saw a crowd of people standing by a lot that was fenced off. It was a very large lot. It contained very large trees. And one of the things to realize in context of this is that Eugene, Oregon has a law, an ordinance, if you will, that says that if you were to cut a tree down that is 50 years old or more, you actually have to have a public forum and a public input, which is pretty much to be expected, of course, of a highly environmental town like Eugene.
Sure.
Basically, they decided that they were going to have a public forum on Monday. They alerted everybody that they were going to have a public forum on Monday. Sunday morning, somebody made a phone call and got a whole bunch of chainsaws down there to cut them down before the public input period, which, of course, enraged a variety of people. This is something I could spend 20 minutes on, so I'll try to nutshell it. There was a lot of tear gas flying. There were a lot of people who were staying uninvolved from the situation, trying to merely, you know, observe from, say, a half a block away, that were getting severely punished for it with tear gas. I'm talking children. I'm talking very old people. Just to encapsulate the total viciousness that went on with it, the crowd was ordered to disperse, and after about a minute, I would say 30% of the crowd began to disperse and started walking. It got about a half a block away, and these were the very obvious targets of the first canisters of tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, making sense of that at the time, it didn't make any sense. It was outrageous. But the people that were actually, you know, on their way out were getting it as if they were going to miss their chance to get them. I mean, that was the only sense that I could make of it in retrospect. And since then, I've come to understand a lot about psychological operations and the psyop that is culture and how those things work. For instance, maintaining a threat is something that is intrinsic to police policy of any kind of policing, whether it is on a global scale or if it is on a local scale. I don't know if you recall, but Humboldt County a few years ago, some activists inhabited Mr. Riggs, Senator Riggs' office, Representative Riggs, who at the time was in bed with Big Timber. Everybody pretty much knew it. There were some teenagers there that got a real vicious treatment. Some were held down and had pepper spray liquid poured directly into their eyes. This was all caught on video. This was caught on video by the very sheriffs that were in the process of doing it. And this video was released to the media by the same sheriffs. Now, if that isn't using psychological operations and mass media to maintain a threat, I don't know what is. You know, it's pretty blatant.
Yeah.
You know? It starts with fear. It's with tyranny. Tyranny is fear. It's oppression. I mean, you don't run in power from something that you have no fear of.
So you basically just stumbled upon this demonstration there in Eugene, huh?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that was drawing me that I had any connection whatsoever to what was going on there or even the fight that was going on around it was a general affinity for some Eugene activists. I mean, I didn't know what was going on. I walked around the corner. There was a crowd. Actually, there was there were news cameras there that would very, very blatantly avert their cameras and turn off their footage at some of the most vicious, what I'll call, without any reservations, torture. There is an outfit called Pickaxe Productions, and I'm not associated with them, and I hope they don't mind my mentioning. But as far as I know, they are the only ones that are still managing to distribute that video.
Oh, interesting.
Of the man in the tree, yeah, who had his pants cut. Nutshell, they arrived. They cut all the branches out of a tree so that he couldn't get down if he wanted to. They refused to put nets under the tree. They went up in a cherry picker and tortured him so that basically to encourage him to fall. You know, after you remove the branches and decline putting the nets that are nearby under the tree, that's attempted murder, in my opinion. They cut open his pants. They sprayed his genitalia. The local news camera was right next to me. He turned it off and turned it away at the moment this began, as if he knew what was coming. What was going in there was a great big parking garage and apartment building for Symantec.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, Symantec has begun to be a major player in local Eugene politics to the angst of a lot of locals.
Oh, they're the ones who produce the Norton antivirus stuff, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
I have
right.
On my very own computer here.
Yeah, and they're probably among the best. I'll never forget when it came out a couple of years ago that the FBI was publicizing that they were going to put out some wares and spyware and whatnot, and Symantec was asked to comment and said that, well, if the FBI puts out a bad trans or a magic lantern or whatever they want to call these Trojans, we would be forced as a matter of integrity to put a blocking against it. Well, it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
yeah.
they're pretty good with their PR and they're pretty good with their antivirus software, but...
So, obviously, that incident in Eugene left some type of strong imprint upon you, and following that, or around that time, you got involved in online activism, which led to Jam Echelon Day, which you were the prime instigator. Tell us about that.
Well, wow, I was a real greenhorn at the time. I was really not used to, I was just getting into the whole internet scene and the whole idea of this sort of a more egalitarian form of mass communication. And I just started reading around. Early on, I was very lucky to come across some people of very high integrity. To this day, I know that if someone new came to the internet, if they weren't a personal friend of mine, I'd wish them a lot of luck in not getting psyoped right into a whole bunch of bogus belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I can't say that it was as prevalent, but it was prevalent enough for me to encourage me, to inspire me to get involved. There was an old email list called Hacktivism, and it was started by some old leftover remnants. They're not going to like the word leftover if they hear this, of the Electronic Disturbance Theater, which in turn had some relationships of some sort that I'm not familiar with to a famous old hacker group called the Cult of the Dead Cow. But Electronic Disturbance Theater and some people that had something to do with that put together this activism mailing list. And you got to understand, too, that at the time, the laws of this country, there was no Patriot Act, there was no Homeland Security Act. General disruption was not illegal. And certainly simply publicizing something, what I would later come to find out is, you know, has always been in a certain way illegal, but has only been made officially illegal. Whistleblowing is now basically an illegal activity. It's been made clear by the fascist state. But what we did was just try to publicize Echelon. And myself and a few other people, I'd have to say Stefan Ray has as much to do.
What's the name again of the other person?
Stefan Ray, but especially Ricardo Dominguez.
Mm-hmm.
Both formerly of the Electronic Disturbance Theater, as well as Grant Bailey, formerly of Wiretap.net. A lot of us got together and just decided we wanted to publicize it. So there was still some greenhornishness even to the hacktivism community in the sense that we didn't know exactly what we were doing. Some of us really wanted to disrupt the system. And some of us really just wanted to draw attention. And some rather uneducated opinions went out on how to conduct this. So what we ended up doing was encouraging people all over the planet to send out emails all at the same time, loaded down with hundreds and hundreds of known Echelon keywords, and Echelon, of course, being a global surveillance system that's been in effect for some 50 years. The wiretapping scandal is kind of just preposterous to me because this has been going on in mass for a long time already.
Under the auspices of who, the NSA?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the National Security Agency and Echelon in its primitive and most primal forms goes back to the National Security Act of 1947, and which was, of course, the National Security Act formed the National Security Agency.
Right.
The emails were supposed to trigger, maybe jam up, see what we could do. See if...
Monkey wrench the system, huh?
Yeah, I mean, if initially it started with the idea that if we could simply by getting everyone online to suddenly begin truly speaking freely, that that would in of itself trip up the system, which was a poetic start to the whole series of brainstorming.
Mm-hmm.
But what it ended up being was a list of known keywords and a call to action that was reproduced in at least seven languages that I'm familiar with. I personally spent probably 60 or 80 hours simply pushing this event on news groups. And it was a funny thing. I got to there's, of course, for a long time now, there have been thousands and thousands of news groups. And I got to a news group that was purportedly dealing specifically with news that having to do with the National Security Agency. And I had been posting on news groups at this point for a few hours. I got to the news group entitled National Security Agency and found that within a minute prior to my arrival, there had been a post made there. And it just simply said, listening. Now, you know, massive coincidence, perhaps. You could make the case that I spent a good deal of the ensuing 5 years involved in one massive coincidence after another, but I maintain that I was involved in what we will call plausibly deniable psychological operations.
Right.
Plausible deniability, of course, is what PSYOPs hides behind. If someone can issue a threat to you in a way that cannot be proven, it'll be done. And if it's done and done and done, you'll start learning how to listen.
Somewhere in one of your blogs, you mentioned this, how you encountered this harassment of a PSYOP's nature, which included, as you said, the effects of sleep deprivation and constant innuendos by people you didn't recognize, attempts to hook you on meth, among other things. And part of this harassment included a woman who was a very close friend of yours for over years who eventually admitted that she had been assigned to you as some sort of handler. Is that right?
Yeah. Her words were, I was assigned to you, quote unquote.
After knowing her for a year, huh?
After knowing her for a year and a half, after living a relatively bohemian life in which you could say that she had much, much opportunity to, we had a lot of opportunity to get into each other's psyches.
This sounds strikingly similar to the type of infiltration, you know, into bohemian groups that went on with the COINTEL program.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the lesson that is being taught, you know, there are countercultural groups. The way I look at it is there are countercultural groups and have been for some time, maybe even still legitimate counterculture rooted in the West Coast, where you are going to find the greatest amount of federal money and effort and dollars and corporate money and effort and dollars and blood and sweat poured into disruption is going to be in the same very places. There's no point in sinking $1 billion into disrupting the populace of New Hampshire, if you get my drift.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, the open eyes and the open mind of humans has been the biggest target, I do maintain. And you don't even have to have an ideology to come up with that conclusion. Getting into your interview that you had a couple of weeks ago with Chica Bruce, I also heard her, I believe, on the Are You Serious show some time ago, where she spoke about the amount of instances in which she has seen phenomena that could be called the UFO phenomena are in themselves, the sheer number of times is baffling. And this is another person who has experienced certain disruption in their lives. It's not just a matter of being able to see. Many of us can see. It's a matter of seeing and being prompted to talk. It's a matter of seeing and being prompted to talk and then find yourself with people listening to you. Once you cross that threshold where you've got an audience, you're on the map.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and with Homeland Security and of course, the Patriot Act today, it's just greater and greater allocation of federal resources toward that very kind of thing.
Now, when Jam Echelon Day went into effect, did you see any immediate fruits come from this?
Actually, what happened a few months later, I was reading an article, I think it was January. Jam Echelon Day happened in October. The following January, there was an article I read somewhere about Echelon's processing, central processing going down somehow. Now, that's months later. It could be construed that we had something to do with that in the sense that before we did what we did, Echelon was not on 60 Minutes. Echelon was just another Internet conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm, right.
So in that sense, we could have led people to, you know, wanting to disrupt it, people with greater means and greater creativity and technical know-how than we had.
Yeah. You mentioned 60 Minutes. I guess sometimes after jam echelon day when you folks brought it to the attention of the world. 60 Minutes picked up the story, huh?
Yeah, and you know, I have since a variety of times gone back and looked for archived 60 Minute segments and not been able to find it. I have found references to the show. There are plenty of those, but going to 60 Minutes and trying to find the show itself, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. I actually, because of the fact that I retreated into a sort of hiding after Echelon and a sort of different lifestyle, I actually didn't I have a whole lot of availability to television at the time.
Right.
And I was growing vegetables, and we didn't have a lot of electricity. I went to the Fringe because I felt my family was endangered.
Sure. You kind of
pulled yourself
out of the off the front to take care of yourself and your family for a while and remove yourself from the harassment.
Oh, well, pretty much. I mean, you know, I had been conducting everything via a webmail account. And a couple of days before Jam Echelon Day, I get an email at my home account in a very interesting crust of English, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
There was aristocracy through every other word, asking me why one gentleman shouldn't be allowed to read another gentleman's mail. You know? And between that and between some other things, I don't know. I mean, at the time, I didn't know necessarily that I really had anything to hide from. But I went to California and did my own version of going underground and would shortly thereafter find out that they were indeed looking for me. And
I guess the Office of Information Awareness, are you familiar with them?
A bit. That
was after the Patriot Act, right?
Oh, yeah. The Office of Information, I don't think it was established by it, but...
Mm-hmm. And weren't they basically doing the same kind of thing that was going on with Echelon?
It really almost seems like what's happening is there is a system of Internet spying. Of course, we must remember the Internet was developed by the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which now is a leg of the Department of Defense. But there really seems to, it seems, I'm going to use some maybe logic here.
You're right.
It seems as if there is an Internet surveillance system that has been in effect in one form or another that through various investigations and various sequences of scandals moves from one government house to another.
Yeah.
And it has gone from the NSA, perhaps even to the FBI, it seems so, with the magic lantern Trojans that were coming out a few years ago and the Klebs virus. There really seems, and now, of course, they had something called Talon, but more recently, the Total Information Awareness Program lives again under another name, and gosh,
yeah,
I could look it up.
Sure, it's interesting that you use the phrase maybe logic. When the Office of Information Awareness appeared on the scene, their logo was the eye in the triangle, which kind of rattled some folks, and, you know, it was a pretty blatant deal. And the term maybe logic either comes from Robert Anton Wilson or he's picked up on it. There's actually an online university called Maybe Logic where Robert Anton Wilson and other folks put on courses. And back, not long after 9/11, I was communicating with Wilson. During that period, interestingly enough, we exchanged a few emails, and he would always CC the emails to, what's his name, John Poindexter, who was the head of basically, it was kind of a joke saying, hey, you're listening in on me anyway. I might as well make the job easier, and maybe you can eliminate one job and save the taxpayers some money.
Robert Anton Wilson, as I think I've explained to you in the past, is someone who, there's an awful lot of Internet lore that follows him around. So much is very positive, and there are conspiracy theories floating around again about Robert Anton Wilson. Mm-hmm. But I maintain that if you read a man's books and it really seems like he's trying to make you smarter, and he does, that he's your friend.
Right. I won't deny that. at one point, there had been these rumors, you know, that he was the head of the Illuminati or one of the heads. And I asked him that question, are you the head of the Illuminati? He said, no, I'm the toe of the Illuminati. But, you know, just the same, I asked him, well, could you appoint me as a high priest in the Bavarian Illuminati? And he did so, and so it goes.
So you're there.
Yeah. Whatever.
Wow, you got like the nice robes now.
No, there's some interference on the line. You hear that?
Actually, on my end, I'm not hearing anything.
Oh, okay. Well, I won't worry about it then. In 1999, you met a fellow in Santa Cruz in a coffee shop there named CIA Ken, which led you to certain revelations regarding 9/11, Eric. Could you share those with our listeners?
Wow, we're really delving into the realm of plausible deniability again.
That's okay.
Where some very ambiguous sets of circumstances, possibly coincidentally a few years later, yielded intense revelations regarding some of the players in 9/11, whom I only recently have begun to find out are some of the same players that have been involved with Echelon for a long time. So, unfortunately, a couple of years after Jam Echelon Day, I got into the whole 9/11 conspiracy bin and started to hit on some of the same companies without even realizing it. I was really climbing up on the list, I do believe.
Mm-hmm.
I got so high that they had to resort to ignoring me, of course, which is that's when you know you've made it, is that they're ignoring you now or trying to unmake you. At any rate, this was an individual who a lot of people had referred to as CIA Ken. Of course, he never introduced himself as CIA Ken. And, you know, you hear stuff like this all the time. There's a certain degree of paranoia that's always just streaming through various strata of our society, often where it doesn't belong. And so I took it with a grain of salt. But I had some interesting conversations with the individual. Now, he, for some reason, was very insistent on driving home one point. And with that point came some suppositions I don't agree with. But the point being that somehow or another, the word meter, M-I-T-R-E, was a good word to remember. Now, the way he put it, this was an old Babylonian god. M-I-T-R-E was the root word of M-E-T-E-R and had to do with measurement. Also true of a little bit of research, I found some mention of meter as being referred to as being in charge of contractual obligations. What all this means, I don't know, but this was all in the context of supposed Masonic lore, which a lot of that is really ambiguous. But I kept that in mind for some reason or another. He also said it's the root word of Maitreya, and there's a guy going around who's an avatar to Masonic lodges who's called the Maitreya, and he has UN backing. He started sounding a little Alex Jones-ish to me in the sense that, you know, when everything comes back to the UN, which is like one of the most marginalized bodies on the planet anymore, I often wonder. But a few years later, I had started a mailing list, a mailing list about psychological operations. I started this mailing list while I was in the throes of being affected by them, which might not have been the smartest thing as far as projecting a clear sense of what was happening, because I was very disoriented for that time. I started to look up this word. It came back to me. I had some free time. I looked at the word meter, and all of a sudden, I believe I was using Google, I saw that Meter, M-I-T-R-E, was a nonprofit defense contractor.
Hmm.
Now, since I have seen it said that Meter is a subsidiary somehow or has some sort of subservience to something called the Jason Group, which, as far as I understand, is a bunch of old Cold War fogies left over who still need something to conquer and have managed to, from the Bay of Pigs till now, stay in power in one way or another. Now, I couldn't even give you their names. It's really hard to find, you know, and I can't comment on that. That's the lore.
Yeah, that's damn interesting. That's the group that Ken Thomas, my guest, last week refers to as the octopus.
The Jason group?
Well, the type of group you're talking about,
right.
It's never mentioned, I believe that I remember as the Jason group, but it stretches back to the apparatus that was behind the Kennedy assassination.
Oh, yeah, I strongly believe that. There are several names that in the wake of the Kennedy assassination and in the wake of Iran-Contra managed to, and Watergate, some of these same names,
yep,
Howard
yep.
Hunt.
Yep,
Frank Carlucci, exactly. Robert McNamara, they show up over and over again. And interestingly, on that vein, in 2002, I talked to a Marine who had just returned from Afghanistan. And I was loath, really, to question him, to put him on the spot. I was loath, really, to even try to milk anything from him whatsoever. But he was quite cooperative with what he perceived to be my wishes, and he told me. He volunteered the information that the anti-Castro Cuban exiles are still extremely powerful, and that's all that he would say about September 11th. So, you know, again, you're going back to the octopus. You wonder why people involved in echelon, the listening of a national security state, are some of the same people that are involved in the military aspect. Your remote control technologies, your over the horizon radar, your chemtrails. Mm-hmm. You know, you're altering the electrostatic environment of the atmosphere for a purpose, and it's signal propagation.
Signal propagation.
Signal various frequencies of radio waves.
Uh-huh.
That can have anything to do with surveillance. It can have radar is radio waves. And radio is weather modification, so there's no way around it. I mean, one of the first things that I wish I could remember the name of the book, but it's about the development of radar.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks very much about how some of the first radar operators and engineers became keenly aware of how they were affecting the radar by just setting these sites to go.
Mm-hmm. Lee Harvey Oswald was an early radar operator.
I see tentacles.
Yeah, indeed.
Of course, it's impossible not to see them now. But.
Right, sure, in retrospect. If we have any listeners out there that want to call in, our number here is area code 347-996-5803. I'll repeat, 347-996-5803, or you can email me with questions at Adam. GoRightly@yahoo.com. Eric, one area I try to go into with each of my guests is the UFO phenomenon, sort of as a running survey to catalog their experiences and to discover common threads connecting all of us to this experience. And what I'm discovering is that a lot of people out there have experienced UFOs, whatever that, you know, they may be. And, in fact, every guest I've had on thus far has had some type of experience with UFOs, and I understand you're no exception.
My first UFO experience, I was too young to remember. If you're going to take the word of my mother and father for it,
mm-hmm.
I
will.
Okay. I don't know. Their history is a little ambiguous, too. But, at any rate, I was probably 3 or 4 years old when they supposedly chased down a UFO. Not so much my mother as much as my father. My father was a real go-getter. He was a real have-to-know kind of person, even at a young age. So I can really see him chasing a light through the woods and then, of course, as he put it, getting scared and turning around. The odd thing about this, I don't remember it. As far as you hear the story told, there was no real direct involvement with me. But over the course, and I have photographic evidence to prove it, over the course of the next couple of weeks, there was a variety of pictures taken with a variety of cameras and a variety of settings. And in some of those, I appeared. And in every one of those, there is a glowing light around only me.
Hmm.
You know, I look back on this stuff. I look at these photos. I mean, half of me wants to just put it away because, I mean, as far as even I've gone into explorations of the UFO phenomena and explorations of consciousness and what all that means, I don't really have an explanation for that.
Mm-hmm.
It almost sounds egotistical to even tell that story.
Right.
As if there, you know, there was something special about me, and it's like, you know, another Jesus phenomenon.
Well, I think there might be, you know, not only you, but a number of people out there, and Chica Bruce comes to mind. She's had scads of UFO experiences, and they seem quite possibly to be the product of the energy she puts off. And perhaps you're putting off the same type of energy.
Invoking now,
whether
a
response, that may, pardon me?
The way I'm understanding you, it sounds as if you're saying I'm pretty much evoking a response from something that is, you know,
well,
extra-dimensional or what have you.
Yeah, that's kind of the areas I've looked into with some of my research. So, you know, that's what I am perhaps suggesting. I can't say these things that for sure, but you know, it seems to come up time and again that the UFO experience is very interactive, and that we help create that experience.
It's interesting because a lot of shamanic traditions, a lot of what I don't remember who coined the term, but it might have been Tim Leary that called the Christianity's Holy Communion a placebo sacrament. In a lot of shamanic traditions where you don't have a placebo sacrament and what you have is something that is mind-altering, you have a very similar tales that have gone on for centuries that remind one of the UFO phenomena, a disembodied sort of floaty other, undefinable, often not even directly seen but perceived on a more instinctive level. You read Charles Castaneda and you understand that Mescalito, this shamanic source, if it exists, is portrayed as a little green man. You know?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, Carl Jung was onto it.
Yeah, a lot of researchers, writers, Jacques Vallée in Passport to Magonia compared the modern-day UFO experiencers to those who witnessed fairies and elves back in, you know, the Celtic days.
The little green men again, absolutely. Coming up from holes in the earth, perhaps? I don't know, but...
Out of the rabbit hole.
And there are plenty of rabbit holes. I don't know, I got a feeling that most rabbit holes lead into one rabbit hole, but... And you know about the rabbits, right? And the rabbits with UFO sightings?
Well, yeah, they relate to it as well. Bob Wilson talks about this, and according to Wilson, the first abductee was Bugs Bunny.
I've forgotten that, yeah.
In a movie that came out in 1947, which was, you know, that was the same year that the modern era of UFOs began with Kenneth Arnold's sightings, and the movie was called Hasty Hair, and that was, I think it was the first one with Marvin the Martian, and Bugs was indeed abducted. And, yeah, Wilson compares, you know, UFOs and these magical experience where we invoke things up, you know, comparing them to, or bringing in the rabbit, the puka, which, who you see in, the, you know, the famous movie with Jimmy Stewart, Harvey. And so, yeah, they're a magical entity that comes out of very old traditions.
Now, wouldn't it be neat if we could just tie that into Easter? Somehow, you know. I think I'm going to invent a conspiracy tomorrow. We'll be real Wilsonian about it and see just how far it goes.
Yeah. Hey, my own UFO experience, which was under the influence of a certain mind-expanding agent, it was indeed a pivotal happening in my life and, you know, led me to the path I'm on. Would you care to talk about your own psychedelic UFO experience you mentioned to me?
Well, we're right back into the shamanic, and by that I mean we're not talking about a placebo sacrament. We're talking about a species that has existed on our planet for a long, long time. Terrence McKenna makes a very strong case. Now, this is going to have a hard time blowing past most people's filters, but it makes a very strong case that the advent of language is directly related to the ingestion of Schafaria cubensis mushrooms on the plains of Africa. Give them a chance. Give yourself a chance to have enough confidence in yourself to make up your own mind or read that book, Food of the Gods by Terence McKenna.
Yeah.
At any rate, I had one of the things about these kinds of psilocin and whatnot with these kinds of substances that I was very lucky to have had in my background was a frame of understanding for these experiences before experiencing them. In that sense, you could refer to it as a sort of shamanic training, an idea of how to handle what was going to be coming my way. Fortunately for me, that meant some 40-year-old, really obscure editions of a magazine that used to come out called the Psychedelic Review.
Oh, yeah, right.
Which is so hard to find anymore, which had Richard Alpert, who later became Brava Brown Das, and Tim Leary, and they talked a lot about the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Well, and, you know, in shamanic tradition, preparation is a big thing.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you don't see the Huichol Indians eating peyote and jumping out of a window thinking they can fly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, that might have been a problem in the 60s that a lot of kids just weren't emotionally, psychically, whatever, prepared to go down.
Well, and I firmly believe it's not for everyone.
Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah.
That isn't something that I've come to rationalize. It isn't something that I've reasoned out. It's something that I've witnessed. It's something I hope to never repeat. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
And there's going to be plenty of people who are sure it's for them and they're wrong.
Well, there was a lot of casualties in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, and you're using the word casualty, I assume, in a sort of loose manner.
In the manner of, you know, you still run into a lot of people these days that are burnouts and living on the streets, and they were part of that movement, but perhaps they weren't prepared for whatever reasons to get heavily into psychedelics, and it, you know, crossing the abyss isn't an easy thing. You need to be prepared.
Oh, and it's not something to be taken lightly. In a sense,
right.
Say crossing the abyss, or the Chapel Perilous, as Wilson might have called it, a place where you find out for the first time if you are comfortable with not having a clear, definable sense of self.
Right.
If you are comfortable with that, you're going to make it.
Well, part of the experience is the ego loss thing, or it's like you're going through a heavy psychedelic experience, and it's like, who the fuck am I? Wow.
Yeah.
And you got to deal with that part of it.
Well, and two, I think a natural response to that, to me, what would be a natural response to that would be an open-ended response. Whereas if you try to come out of it and say, you know, I will define who I am so that I can write it down, I need to hear it in my head in English and say it aloud, you're basically shoving an infinite peg into a finite hole and it will never happen. And, you know, that's what you call a bad trip.
Well, and the flip side of that is you understand that your life is unwritten and you have the chance to make of it what you will.
Well, and sometimes that'll be made unconsciously in the sense that, well, for example, the experience that started this last trade, the UFO experience, it wasn't something that I was expecting. It wasn't something I was looking for. I was on my way down a hillside in Northern California. I lived at a relatively alternative community. It was actually a massage school. You may have heard of it. It's called Harbin Hot Springs. And I was on my way down this hillside going to a weekly dance that we had, which is sort of an expressive kind of dance, you know. A real get-together, a groovy kind of time. And I was walking down the hillside with several friends of mine, and I saw something off to my right in the sky that absolutely mesmerized me, on a purely intellectual level at least. I looked down at the people that were in front of me walking down the hill. One rather auspicious thing about the whole event was that they never looked back. They kept going, and I would have considered it really sort of beyond the realm of possibility that they would ever just forget I was there and just leave me in the woods. But that's exactly what they did, and perhaps it's a good thing. What I saw in the sky is one of those things that I've worked very hard to describe, and I'll tell you right now, it's going to fall short of what I experienced.
Sure.
But the best that I've been able to do to encapsulate this into English was that there was a ball shape, a spherical shape, moving absolutely silently through the sky in a very gentle but seemingly perfect arc that shed its own light. It was not reflective. I perceived that it was not reflective. That had an oddly metallic quality in the sense that it looked like a ball of mercury, only a ball of mercury looks much more tangible than what I saw. Now, this very space around this object, not the air, the atmosphere, but the very space around this object seemed to shimmer. And I really got this sense, you know, a rabbit hole kind of sense. Was it an object? Is it a door? Is there a difference? Obviously, I was entertaining a lot of lofty concepts on that day to begin with. But this is something that goes way, way back in the history of tryptamines, which includes your ayahuasca squirrels who use DMT snuff and your mushroom cults of Mexico that have been around for a long time. They not only consistently experience little green men and disembodied entities floating around, they also have a unique quality, these tryptamines, that a whole tribe can take the ayahuasca and afterwards, without ever speaking to each other during the entirety, afterwards they all agree on what the vision was and they all saw the same thing. Now that in itself, because that is something that can be proven, though it's not something that can be quantified, I suppose if you wanted to create a study group and study the potentials of this, you could say that, well, we couldn't rule out that they got together beforehand and said what they would say, but, you know, you got to trust your own judgment enough to know when you're talking with these people if they're pulling your leg or not.
Or that they've created their own mem.
And that is something that repeats outside of shamanic cultures, too, with tryptamines.
Mm-hmm. Right.
People seeing the same thing,
well,
not
with,
talking about it till afterwards.
Well, with Terrence McKenna, what he talked about under the influence of DMT, the he called them machine elves, and terrain he described in his writings has been experienced by a lot of people who have also experimented with DMT.
Yeah, it's I actually haven't. There was a period of time in which it was the Holy Grail that I sought. And, you know, I quit seeking, and, you know, I suppose if it's my karma and I'll need it at some point, it'll come my way. But
exactly.
I'm not particularly seeking it out. I feel I have a vague understanding of where the other psychedelic experiences are all generally pointing.
Mm-hmm.
And if dimethyltryptamine is the cutting edge of all of this, then
it will come.
You know? I don't know anything about machine elves. I have a gut, even though I am a devout McKenna fan, I have a gut reaction, a sort of gut apprehension against the idea of a machine, anything appearing in my visions. I'm more of an organic, I guess.
That was his terminology, as Wilson says. The map is not the territory, but you know that's how he framed it.
Well, McKenna, too, he went back and forth a lot between I would listen to a rant of his and he would sound like what I would call 100% organic, you know, and I would listen to another rant of his and say, my God, he's a transhumanist, you know, and I've heard very conflicting stuff now, you know, it could, again, be a matter of he's dealing with concepts that our small minds haven't graduated to yet. I mean, it's very difficult to tell, but yeah, the UFO phenomena is a phenomena I think that can be divided into two categories. One is largely extinct Cold War technology, and the other is a recurring phenomena that has gone on perhaps for centuries or millennia, perhaps for eons.
I can't disagree with you there. I mean, those are two of the obvious explanations, and there's no reason they can't coexist together.
Well, absolutely. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they do. They coexist in this world. In this world, we have a UFO phenomena, which seems to be a byproduct of a sort of hyper-conscious interaction between an individual and his environment or an individual and something.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we have, well, take a look at the front of the B-2 bomber from directly head-on sometime and tell me if it isn't saucer-shaped.
Hmm.
It's called radar evading profiles. Hitler never got into radar. Hitler, in my opinion, is he never got into radar because he thought he had a beat with the development of saucer-shaped craft. Oh. Obviously, the other experience is a lot more intriguing.
Right. We're coming up to the top of the hour here, and it'd be a good time for you to talk about what you're doing these days and where we can plug into different blogs and things you're doing. I guess it's just one blog now.
Well, yeah, I've bounced around a lot now. One of the things that that has sort of been a source of angst for me in the past is I've created this sort of onion effect between the information distribution that I'm involved in, you could call it activism, in which I sort of, if I were to go right out there with some of the information about Meter Corporation and 911, for instance, and I were to preface it,
mm-hmm.
with the discussion we just had on psychedelics and UFOs.
Yeah.
What I consider to be important information
Couldn't
go anywhere.
Right.
So what that, I had...
That's talking about two things coexisting together. There's no reason they can't.
And, yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, it seems to me like if you get into these matters, if you're really into exploring the mysteries of life, the real mysteries of life, you are going to be led into a realm that is largely inhabited with conspiracy theorists.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd mentioned that to me, how your research into 9/11 kind of conflicting with work you're, you know, doing with global warming.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a real simple, it's such a simple dichotomy to think that it exists in the far-left environmental communities, the far-left socialist, activist-oriented communities, whether they be online or whatnot, that this same kind of mind block, mental block, exists on the far right in a totally reverse form. The example that I gave you, and I'll give to listeners right now, is that my research into September 11th, which was sparked by being in the right place at the right time to hear something that later on opened up a Pandora's box. I didn't start out with some special insight into terrorism or anything like that. What I found from 911 researchers is that if I let on that I believe global warming is real, I have ceased to be listened to by 75% or more of the community.
Mm-hmm.
The 911 community. The reverse side of that is, and I'm sure some of your listeners have already been, oh, no, not this far-right conspiracy. You know, I would imagine that your show draws a broader sort of intellect. But at any rate, on the environmental side of that, all I have to do is show that I believe that September 11th was an inside job, and there's one more organic farm I'll never work at. You get the idea? I mean, I'm in the middle of having alienated almost everybody, and once I realized that, it was a lot easier, A, to let go of, say, this. The September 11th research has been a ball and chain for a lot of us.
Mm-hmm.
It has been something that, as important as what we looked into was, and as much important stuff as we've uncovered, we've taken it to the people. The people are, by and large, I think more people are entertaining these ideas now than ever. It's not going to be in a court of law. And Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Pearl, these guys, they're not going to go to jail. No. But we may have done more in this capacity than any previous generation. So it freed me up to feel like, okay, I've done my deal with September 11th. You know, I've run this into the ground. I've analyzed this from a billion different viewpoints. And if I can't say anything more on the subject, here's the baton, America. And that was my last piece on September 11th, and it's been liberating.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I am free in my psyche to pursue matters that have been left neglected for some time now.
On that note, we're going to call it a wrap here. This has been a... fascinating hour of discussion. talk about your blog, where folks can go, and what I'll do is post that on the Untamed Dimensions website here, but just talk briefly of that and any other parting words you have, Eric.
Well, the blog is at destabilize.blogspot.com, and initially it was a blog that was to deal entirely with psychological operations, but it has since become a broader expression of my views of everything from the conspiratorial to matters of consciousness. Recently, it's taken on a more personal tone. I've been posting an occasional music video. A Vintage Floyd video was posted there recently. I've been going a little bit into the subject of disembodied entities, or what is otherwise known as the UFO phenomena. And who knows where else it's going to go. I have no idea where it's going to go. This whole trip for the last 10 years has been long and strange.
Yeah, that's the way it should work. You follow it to where it takes you.
And it is a rabbit hole. It was there before you got there. You're not going to dig it.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you.
You're going to follow.
Thanks a lot for coming on today, and it was a great hour. I know.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're reticent of coming on after Ken Thomas, but...
Yeah, I knew that would be a hard act to follow. I mean, in the sense that if I were to even think in that terms, Ken Thomas is a phenomenal researcher because he hasn't, unlike a vast majority, he hasn't allowed the sensational to dominate
mm-hmm.
his pursuit.
Yeah, right.
He's a lot more objective than that, I think.
Hey, thank you much, Eric. I'm going to let you go now.
Thank you.
Stay in touch.
All right, take care.
Okay, you too. So, thus brings to a close another mind-obliterating edition of Untamed Dimensions. Join us again next week, or whenever it is we do our next show, for another adventure into these arcane waters. So, thanks again, one and all, for listening. From the Great American Heartland to the pyramidal structures on Mars. Until that time, Maxwell, until that time.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again.
This has been a Filmways presentation, darling.